Welcome to the New Books in Political Science podcast. My name is Heath Brown, and today I'll be talking to the two authors of The Authority Trap, Strategic Choices of International Non-Governmental Organizations. The book is published by Cornell University Press this year. I have Sarah Stroop and Wendy Wong on the phone. Sarah, how are you?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Yeah, and Wendy, you're there as well.
Yes, I am. Thanks.
Good. Thank you both. What I'd like to do is give you each the chance to introduce yourself, and then we'll talk about this really interesting book. Sarah, would you like to go first? Just tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. I'm an associate professor of political science at Middlebury College, and Wendy and I have been working on this book together since about 2012 or 2013. Before that, I authored Borders Among Activists, which was also published by Cornell, and thus have been thinking about international NGOs for what feels like a really long time.
Great. And Wendy, how about yourself?
I'm also an associate professor of political science at the University of Toronto. And like Sarah said, we've been working on this project together for a number of years, and before that had been collaborating as well. My first book was also on Cornell University Press, and it was called Internal Affairs. And I was really interested in how the internal organizational structure of INGOs affects their global influence.
Yeah, and this is the focus of the book. Sarah, maybe we can just start with you. And the focus here is on international non-governmental organizations, or INGOs. Would you maybe offer us a definition of what a INGO is exactly?
I'm happy to. It is one of the perennial challenges of studying in this field. So non-governmental organizations are defined by what they are not. They are not public institutions. And international non-governmental organizations, according to the standard definition by the UIA, operate in three or more countries. There's a lot of fuzziness around the boundaries of what are the INGOs that we care about in global politics. For example, we might not study the International Football Association as much as we study the International Chamber of Commerce or Amnesty International. But in general, non-governmental organizations all share a commitment to some public benefit activities, something beyond their own membership. And they do not make profits. They spend their money on their social mission.
Now, Wendy, to deepen that a little bit and relate it to the book, you distinguish between leading INGOs and other INGOs. What is the difference there? And maybe you can mention a couple of the typical examples that fall into each of these two categories.
Sure. Yeah. So this gets at the heart of why Sarah and I decided to write the book that we did. So in the past couple of decades, there's been a lot of interest from both the scholarly and I would say the policymaking community on the role of INGOs in global politics in terms of thinking about what they're doing, the kinds of influence they have over different outcomes that we care about. And so we were trying to figure out a way to study these actors, these INGOs, systematically across cases and across sector. So a lot of times when people are interested in studying INGOs, they're interested in environmental INGOs or human rights INGOs. And we wanted to study them as a group of types of actors engaged in global politics. So we were really trying to define what their influence might be. And we sort of hit on this idea that part of their influence has to do with the fact that different audiences accept their authority. So we were trying to distinguish between those INGOs that have authority and those that don't. And it turns out, I don't want to skip too far ahead, but some INGOs have a lot of authority for multiple audiences. So we call those the leading INGOs. And many, many more INGOs, in fact, the great majority of INGOs in the world don't have authority. And so we call those other INGOs. That's sort of a more of a catch-all category. But leading INGOs are some of the ones that Sarah's already mentioned. They're the ones that we tend to think of offhand. So like the World Wildlife Fund, Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, Médecins Sans Frontières, or Doctors Without Borders, for example.
Now, with this as the focus, Sarah, you have a sort of a central paradox for these leading INGOs. In some ways, what you call the trap in your title. Why do these leading groups not act more boldly? You seem to sort of have this argument that they are leading, but they don't exactly lead in every case. They seem to prefer more incremental change over radical change. Would you unpack that paradox, if that's the right way to frame it, or maybe there's another way to think about the central tension in the book?
Yeah, there is that tension, and it is a paradox. So yes, as Wendy described, one of the things that we do in the book is we try to measure INGO authority. But what you're discussing is the causal claim that we try to unpack, which is how the different levels of authority that international NGOs have affects the strategies that they choose when they're trying to interact with various audiences. The audience might be states, it might be corporations, or it might be some of their peer groups. What we argue in the book is that it is really hard for an international NGO to become an authority. Unfortunately, or if you're a sympathizer of international NGOs, unfortunately, most INGOs are ignored in global politics. So it's a rare event to become one of these leading INGOs. Because it's so hard to secure this authoritative status, those INGOs that are leading ones have to work very hard to maintain that status. That is, they have to make sure that they maintain deference from the audience that they're interacting with. This leads them to pull their punches a little bit. We refer to the sorts of policy pursuits of leading INGOs as vanilla victories. They tend to choose policy asks and political strategies that might move the ball a little bit, but are not so radical as to alienate their audiences. People might come to different conclusions about whether this is a good or a bad thing. On one hand, they are victories. These are changes from the status quo. On the other hand, they seem to be incrementalists, and many of their peers think that they are not radical or not substantial enough.
Yeah, it's such an interesting argument. And Wendy, I wonder if you can talk a little bit about how you did this book. What did you do? You've worked on the book for a number of years. What's the method that you used? How did you collect your data?
Yes, that's a very good question. I was just going to say, other than talking endlessly about what we were observing and how to explain it. So one of the first steps we had to do, as Sarah alluded to, was collect data on international NGOs. I mean, what do they look like and how do we think about their authority? How can we measure that? It's such a an ambiguous and social concept, right? So in a way, we had to figure out the right measures. And so first, we figured out the relevant audiences for INGOs, and we settled on the three that Sarah's mentioned, so states, peer INGOs, and corporations. And we also thought we can't do an analysis of INGOs without thinking about this idea of the global public. So then we set out to find the data out there or ways that we could, you know, even think about these ideas systematically in terms of how INGOs are securing authority before all these different types of audiences. So we ended up relying on a number of different types of sources. So some of the data we collected originally, so data on newspaper accounts, for example, that was as part of the idea of the global public. We also collected Google Trends data. So what kinds of things are people searching for? Which INGOs occur to people to actually type into their computer to search on Google? We also consulted some available data from some of our colleagues with regard to the way that INGOs network with each other and the way that they talk about each other in terms of who is a good INGO versus others that are not. We look at the way that legislatures talk about INGOs and which INGOs are getting cited or called before the U.S. Congress as expert witnesses. We looked at some corporate data, although that the relationships between INGOs and corporations is notoriously difficult to study. So that's a little bit more limited, but we talk about how how that how people have studied those relationships systematically in the book. So we had first we had to do this large data gathering exercise to show that authority is actually quite rare among INGOs, and it's even rarer for them to have authority before multiple audiences. So securing authority before one audience is pretty tough. Securing authority before two or more audiences, as you can imagine, is even harder.
Yeah.
From there,
Please continue.
From there, we then looked at some comparative case studies in the latter part of the book, focusing specifically on three audiences, states, other INGOs, and corporations, to try to unpack some of the dynamics that we think are shaped by the either leading INGO status or other INGO status. So thinking about the strategies that INGOs use in their interactions with different audiences.
Yeah, and Sarah, I wanted to have you talk a little bit about a couple of the case studies. You focus on the arms trade and global finance. What do we learn about the strategies and activities of these leading INGOs in these two cases, especially when they work in coalition with other organizations?
Yeah. One of our challenges was choosing cases where we were likely to see many of these leading INGOs get involved. Much of the wonderful research that's been done so far on INGOs has been done in specific sectors, like Wendy mentioned earlier. So we were looking for cases where you could potentially have lots of different actors in, because it wasn't clear whether it was a security issue or a human rights issue or an environmental issue. So we chose two campaigns, the campaign for the arms trade treaty and the campaign for the financial transactions tax. And we additionally chose these campaigns because the composition, the membership of the campaign changes over time. And in each campaign, they're started by other INGOs, but then a leading INGO or two comes in. And so we can actually see the effects on the campaign from the entrance of one of these high status INGOs. In both cases, the entrance of these high status NGOs led them to get more prominence than they had before. So that's the victory part. But it also changed the policy ask of each of the campaigns. So I'll illustrate this in talking about the financial transactions tax campaign. In the news, this is often referred to as the Robin Hood tax. Here in the United States, Bernie Sanders' campaign and National Nurses United has been part of this. And like Robin Hood, the goal of the tax is to steal from rich bankers, just a little tax on the side of their currency or financial transactions, and spend that money on global public goods. Interestingly, this policy idea started out as a really radical critique of neoliberal capitalism. It was first suggested by Nobel Prize winning economist James Tobin, who famously said that we could, quote, throw sand in the wheels of commerce, that we could slow down speculative currency movements that were disrupting economies around the world. As this campaign emerges over time, it moves further and further away from this critique of capitalism and more towards a fairly unobjectionable idea that we could raise a little money on the side to deal with climate change mitigation or healthcare. Part of that move was driven by the entrance of Oxfam, a leading INGO in the campaign. Oxfam is incredibly effective at packaging policy asks and raising public attention. But they also suggested a level of the tax that was much lower. If you ask for a higher tax, it is more likely to actually get in the way of financial transactions. If it's a very small marginal tax, it won't slow down the number of transactions, but it will raise a little bit of revenue. So we argue that this is a vanilla victory. This is, yes, more attention to the FTT issue than had existed before when it's being considered by a small group of European states today. But it is a less radical idea than other organizations had been suggesting in the mid-1990s.
Yeah, and this finding, it really runs, I think, counter to what we would expect or hope from these leading INGOs. So, Wendy, if they're not at nearly as bold and successful in their interactions with states, it must be the case when they interact with corporations, things look differently. You have a really interesting chapter on those interactions between the INGOs and corporations, these corporate campaigns. Is the story similar or very different to the one that Sarah just told?
So when we talk about corporations and INGOs, a lot of times they're seen as very different, right? They're coming from completely different market orientations, and they are, in fact, often characterized as opposites. So our finding in the book is that, in fact, when INGOs, and especially leading INGOs, interact with corporations, they sort of follow the same kind of moderating strategies that they do with states as well, for a number of reasons. But, you know, INGOs, because they see corporations as a relevant audience to their work, and a lot of times what they're doing is critiquing or collaborating with corporations, leading INGOs can't make too many waves if they want to continue keeping the attention and, in fact, the deference, the sort of looking to INGOs for guidance in the behavior of corporations, or at least getting corporations to even respond to INGO claims about what they should corporations should or should not be doing. So what we find is that there is a lot of variation among INGOs when they interact with corporations, but leading INGOs tend to be moderate. They tend to go for vanilla victories, where other INGOs might not be so constrained with their behavior. And we illustrate this with a number of case studies, because we can look at several strategies with regard to how INGOs interact with corporations. So with the leading INGOs, we look at the case of Walmart and the sustainability consortium that they've set up that has membership from a lot of other corporations, some members of civil society and some members of academia. And we find that although the TSC, as it's called, has advanced a number of important standards for thinking about sustainable corporate behavior, it is a non-binding solution. And so it is probably more of a moderate solution than many INGOs might otherwise want from corporations in terms of shaping behavior. We also look at the UN Global Compact, which is an agreement started by the UN, by Kofi Annan, that asks corporations to be to change their practices for sustainability, not just environmentally, but also socially and thinking about human rights and humanitarian concerns. And there again, we find that leading INGOs are involved, but the UN, that entire project in and of itself, is often criticized for blue washing, for not being as bold as it could be. And finally, we look at the Forestry Sustainability Council with regard to sustainable forestry products to sort of show that sometimes INGOs can actually compete with corporate efforts. And so the FSC actually competes with corporate-sponsored solutions to creating sustainable forestry products. And that's an interesting dynamic, but it's not one that many leading INGOs have bought into.
Now, just in the interest of sort of wrapping up our conversation, I wonder if each one of you could talk a little bit about the response to the book so far. I don't know how widely disseminated the book is yet, but I imagine some of the people that you have interviewed and talked to and interacted with over the last number of years have read some portion of this and gather what your findings are. Sarah, have you gotten feedback from people who are deeply immersed in the world of INGOs, and whether they agree with the findings of the book or take issue with them? What's been the response so far?
Yeah, we've shopped this idea in advance of publication to some of our trusted friends in the NGO sector. And so we have, I think, a little bit of a sense of how this lands. And I might say that I've heard at least three different reactions from practitioners. One, from some friends who work for smaller NGOs, have questioned whether NGOs truly do seek authority. And I think Wendy and I would concede that there is a substantial group of NGOs that are not looking to get more attention from more audiences, but they're just looking to work on one or two tasks in one or two countries and kind of do those well for an established donor base. But I would say that we think that that category of not authority-seeking NGOs is fairly small, simply because the world that NGOs exist in is a very uncertain one. You might lose your funding base. The country that you work in may become more hostile to what you're doing. And so securing more attention, getting bigger audiences may be necessary for organizational survival. The second reaction that we've heard from a lot of people who work in smaller NGOs is, I think, that this rings true somewhat, that they are frustrated by how some of their partners in these powerful organizations have pulled back a little bit on the asks of any policy proposal. I don't want to overstate how substantiated our findings are, because I'm sure that there are lots of cases where that's not true. But we've heard a number of stories saying that we're definitely on thing. The last interesting thing that I'll say that we've heard from practitioners is that from the leading INGOs, this is a bit of a challenge to what they do, but perhaps a healthy one. And I think for me, if there's a practical outcome of our book project, it is to encourage these incredibly prominent and well-respected organizations to push themselves a little bit more than they might otherwise. If this book can help some staffers at some leading INGOs fight some internal battles to be a little bit more ambitious, then I'll feel pretty good about that.
And Wendy, how about yourself? Are you getting the same feedback? I know you're probably getting this together, but is this the response that you expected from the non-academic audience that I'm sure is interested in the book?
Yeah, I think, you know, Sarah articulated some of the major concerns and responses we've gotten. I would just add, I think that two other responses we've gotten are one, you know, what is our perspective in this book, right? Are we, you know, it sort of goes both ways. I think it depends on when we're talking and to whom we're talking and what stage, you know, this project has been at. But sometimes we get characterized as a cynical, right? Because we think about this as a trap. And so, you know, leading INGOs do this and other INGOs do that, and they can't help, or it's very difficult for them to resist these pressures. And I see that as if you are in an NGO, it might seem negative, but you know, this is an analysis of larger trends and general strategies that INGOs adopt. And I think part of what Sarah was touching on is exactly, you know, this fact that we're coming at it not from within an INGO, but looking at INGOs writ large as a category or type of actor, and we're trying to understand their role broadly speaking. And so the dynamics we find are not necessarily going to, you know, be 100% descriptive of how INGOs are experienced from within, or how people who work within INGOs or have worked in many INGOs necessarily see as their role. So that's one thing, and I think it wasn't a surprising response, given that we are finding these dynamics that affect INGO strategies and limit their behaviors and their choices. But that's something that I think, you know, has been an interesting response nonetheless. And we do get lots of questions about whether there's a way out of the trap. And, you know, again, this is a general dynamic we find, which we think tells us a lot about the behavior of INGOs you know, when we look at them in general, but of course there are specific instances where it doesn't apply. And that's the sort of the beauty of social science.
Yeah. Right? The book again is The Authority Trap, Strategic Choices of International NGOs, published by Cornell University Press. The authors who you've been hearing from are Sarah Stroop and Wendy Wong. Sarah and Wendy, thank you both very much for your time today.
Thank you very much, Heath. It's been great to be here.